So welcome. I'm the substitute teacher tonight. I heard that y'all were warned, but I expect everybody to behave, even though I'm subbing in. My name is Karen Mastriani. I'm one of the facilitators for Buddhism in a Nutshell. There are several of us. We all follow the same outline and format, so we try to keep a relative consistency between all of us. And we have a lot to cover tonight. I've been a member of the center for 11 plus years now, I guess. It feels like much longer than that in a good way. It was, you know, finding your path, you know, when you're searching and you find it. And it just seems like it's always been a part of me. And whether this is your path or not, you're going to get good information that will help you be a better person. And if you decide that this is your path, there's lots of other study options for you. So I also do volunteer work with the Prism Project through Kadampa Center. I teach a meditation class to a medium security prison. We're going to start a minimum one soon. And that's a great volunteer activity to do. Then I also coordinate the drivers for our teacher, Geshe-la, as well as visiting teachers. If any of you are going to have a chance to hear Venerable George, he's our visiting teacher now. So we can, you know, we can make this informal, ask me questions. If I say something that you heard otherwise from another teacher, feel free to mention that and correct me. I'm always open for suggestions. We have several new people here. I've met a couple. Who else is here for the first time tonight? Hello, welcome. So as I told the other two, you're going to feel like you dropped in the middle of things. But I'm sorry. Yeah, that's good. You'll be right at home. But, you know, you always feel like that here. The first time I ever came was to a Discovering Buddhism class. It's a 2-year class. And I came to the last one, which was Death and Dying. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm out of here. So I started over with the new one. Then you realize you still feel like you got dropped in the middle of everything. So, all right. So before we start with a quick review and start tonight's topic, let's just do just a quick meditation just to bring our presence back to this room, let go of the stresses of the day, and just kind of set our intentions, which is a real important process in Buddhism. So many of you know how to sit, and you want to sit comfortable. If you're in a chair, feet flat on the floor. You want your back straight, head tilted slightly forward. It's almost like you have a string pulling from the crown of your head, and your spinal column is a stack of blocks, and it's just pulling you straight up. Your arms should be relaxed, but a little bit away from your body. Your eyes slightly closed or slightly open. And your tongue at the top of your teeth. And in this tradition, we put our right palm in our left with our thumbs together. And just take a few deep breaths. Become present to this space. Remember that the whole purpose of meditation is to become familiar. The word in Tibetan is gom, to be familiar. Meditation releases us from the uncontrolled mind and thoughts that we have continuously, our polluted mind. And by focusing on the breath, we can help to control those thoughts. As a thought occurs, just let it float by. Don't pay attention to it. Don't engage. No judgment. Just observe. And since you've been doing this for a few weeks now, as you focus on your breath and count them, I want you to really look at the space between breaths, the space between thoughts. See if you can feel that space and just rest there for a few seconds. Think about your reasons for being here this evening. Out of all the things you could be doing on this cool, rainy evening, you made the effort to come here. Rejoice in that. Set the intention that you want to cultivate a positive, happier mind. And in so doing, you'll benefit yourself, your own well-being, as well as the well-being of those around you. And just notice the sense of calm and peace you feel when you stop the chattering in your mind, and even just a few minutes like this has positive benefits. Could you kind of feel that space between the breaths or get a little glimpse of that somewhat? What's interesting is the more you do this, then you realize that when you're confronted with situations in real life, you realize there's a pause. And before you react or jump into something, you know, you'll start noticing that pause or that space. So it's very beneficial. And setting intentions, not just for your Buddhist practice, but for everything that you do. Like even in our work, we start our day by setting intentions. And, you know, people who work for us aren't Buddhists, and it doesn't matter. It's such a positive way to start your day. And so doing that, you know, in other practices in your life can really be beneficial. So I encourage that as well. The intentions and dedications are like the two bookends for what you're doing and then reviewing, you know, what you did. So very helpful. So I understand last week you covered lots of great material, talked about rebirth, karma. Did you talk about the 10 non-virtuous actions? Yes, at least one shaking her head. We'll quickly review, you know, some of that information. You know, for me, if I hear something once, it means nothing. And then, so we'll review a little bit tonight. And then tonight, we're going to spend time on precious human rebirth and the Buddhist perspective of that. And then the Buddhist thinking on death. And, you know, and just remember that all these topics, we're barely skimming the surface. So it really is an introduction and to give you an idea so that at least you can know a little bit about the practice and then hopefully study more if you're interested. We'll touch on the three scopes of the Lam Rim, which is the path, how we're going to get out of suffering and samsara, and the three aspects of that path, what the practice is. So, karma. So if you recall, karma just means action. Venerable Rabina and other teachers use the term intention because it's not just our physical action, but it's actually a mental process. So you can think of it as an intention. And there are a couple of laws pertaining to karma that you might remember. I wrote some of them up there. But when you think about karma, we understand the law of cause and effect. Like, we know that law in a physical aspect, and karma is just the psychological aspect of cause and effect. What we do leaves an imprint or a seed. Everything we do, every thought that we have leaves that imprint. There's no cosmic scoreboard in the sky. There's no scorekeeper up there. It's just the law of cause and effect that just naturally happens. And there's not necessarily a judgment either. You just either do a non-virtuous action or a virtuous action, and there's cause, you know, there's an effect by what we do. So some of the laws is that karma is definite. Virtuous actions will always produce happiness. Non-virtuous actions will always produce suffering, period. On a physical level, it's simple to think about. You plant an apple seed, you don't expect to grow lemons. You plant a lemon tree, you don't expect to get apples from your lemon tree. You're going to get lemons. And it's the same with karma. So that is definite. Karma expands over time. So if you do something generous and you dedicate that and you let it, dedicating actually helps the generosity, it continues to grow. You do something non-virtuous and you don't purify or take steps to get rid of it, that grows as well. They say, you know, one angry outburst can just wipe out eons of, you know, positive, virtuous actions that we do. So it will expand. There's no result without a cause. So anything that is happening in your life now happened from imprints that you've had. So you won't experience anything if there wasn't a cause. Make sense? And then it's not lost. There is no expiration date. Karma is there. You can do things to purify it. You can kind of reduce it some through purifications, and with strong purifications you can actually, you know, get rid of negative karma. You can eliminate it. And then there's four aspects of karma. So what we experience is, I don't know if you can read my writing. Did I spell things right? No. So it's my spelling for ripening. I looked at that. Funny how it jumps out at you. So karma ripens in our rebirth is one of the main ways that it ripens, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. What form will we take when we come back? And to be grateful for the form we have now and use it to our best. The possessed result, which is the environment we're born in. I mean, here we are, born in the United States, in Raleigh, with one of the largest Tibetan centers in the U.S. and really worldwide. So how incredibly fortunate is that? And I always think about that. You know, I'll have these conversations with my mom where I'll just niggle at her, like, you know, why do you think we were born here and not in India where there's people starving? And, you know, that's just the way God made it, you know. Because we could be in a war zone. We could be living somewhere with no water, no food. And then that you'll experience the results similar to the cause. So if you stole from somebody in the past, people could be stealing from you now. If you lied in the past, you could be lied to today. I have this habit of exaggerating. I'll probably do it tonight. And I really try hard not to exaggerate, because you create that habit of lying and exaggerating in the future. And we accept exaggeration or little white lies as okay, but those create causes and habits that will ripen later. So even that is really not harmless. And then creating the results similar to the cause. So our tendencies are habits. If you have a tendency to kill or steal, then you know that is your habit that may continue. And the prison work that I do, it's interesting. You know, I don't know if any of you have been in a prison. It's not a pleasant place. And there's a lot of bugs in the room we're in. So I go in and you try to kind of corral bugs out of the room because they come in and they step on them. You don't ever want to make anybody feel bad for what they do. And so I try to get the bugs out. But these couple times they've seen me, and it's very interesting because they're not necessarily compassionate to the bugs or want to save their lives, but they get they don't want to create habits anymore and that killing is a habit they want to stop. And so they've rescued spiders and they've rescued wasps that were in the room. So it's pretty amazing. So, you know, you want to kind of think about those causes. And actually, if you think about your life today, you have a pretty good idea of who you were in the past, what your mind stream was like. And if you think about what you're doing today, you're predicting your future lives, if you believe in past lives or future lives. So we are creating our lives through what we do. You know, some people say it's like being in a hotel room. Are you going to leave the hotel kind of cruddy by all these non-virtuous things, or are you going to leave it nice? Because you could come back into that same hotel room at some point. So you can change your reality. Questions about karma? Anything bubble up for you during the week? No? Okay, good. This scratches the surface of karma. This, you could spend years studying karma. And then you talked about rebirth, and I'm sure that Sandy talked about the moments of mind and that each moment of mind had a previous moment of mind, and they say that in a snap of a finger, you've had 64 moments of mind. And they, you know, if you follow this moment from the last moment, you can just keep going back and back and back. And there are meditations that you can do, you know, just to help you kind of think about that, going back as well as even going forward. And usually in the fourth class, we do an analytical meditation on equanimity, and we'll do that one. But there's one on this kind of consciousness, this mind stream and the continuity of mind. If you're interested, we could do that one now. If that would just help you kind of think about those moments of mind. Or do you want to just keep going? You want to keep going? Any other votes? Keep going? Okay. It's in the book, How to Meditate, and it's a wonderful meditation. So I do encourage that whenever you'd like to do it. Ten non-virtuous actions. So you have non-virtuous actions that we do with our body, with our speech, and with our mind. Who remembers the three non-virtuous actions of body? Anybody? Chris Baranski, he's a ringer. So that's good. He gave you a hint. Killing. What's the other non-virtuous actions we do with our body? Nobody takes notes. I'm such a note taker. I'd be looking at my notes right now. And it's interesting, for the death and dying part of this, it's very limited in this class. And I went back to my notes from Discovering Buddhism, which, Elise, when was that? 2004 that we took it? Yeah, and I still have my notes. I don't know. Now it sounded neurotic, not like a good thing. But anyhow, I thought it was a good thing when I found them. So the three actions we do with our body are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. And then you have four actions of your speech, which is lying and exaggeration, white lies, all count, harsh speech, anger, harming another, slander, anything that's divisive, where you're saying things to pit people against each other, even more consequences when you do these in a Dharma setting, and gossip, where we spend so much of our idle time chit-chatting and gossiping and thinking it's okay. Thanks, Chris. And then there's three of mind. Covetousness, which is jealousy, wanting what others have. It's kind of that greed, always wanting what you don't have. Ill will, which is angry feelings towards others. It's interesting because when we do something, we judge our own behavior by our intention. So we didn't intend to hurt anybody. We didn't intend for that to come out that mean. But when we judge others, we judge them by their behaviors or the outcome and not their intention. So it's just kind of interesting how we do that. And just watch your mind. Think about situations, and that just comes up over and over again. And you really have to make an effort just to say everybody's intentions were good. And not very often is it proven otherwise. So that can be kind of helpful with ill feelings. And if you think about anger, His Holiness has said, and I heard Geshe-la say it as well, anger is like taking a poison and wishing the other person would be harmed. It truly is. You're just only harming yourself. And then the third one of mind is wrong view, that we just have the complete wrong view of self and reality and the way things truly exist. Any questions about the 10 non-virtuous actions? And the only thing I want to say about these is, every religion has, the Ten Commandments or thou shalt not, and, these aren't any different than those. Probably the greatest difference is that there is no judger and there is no judgment. You do something that's harmful, it harms you, it harms others. So there's no moral compass saying that except for our own moral compass. So it truly is without judgment. It's just knowing nobody wants to suffer. Rabina always says, take a poll, ask somebody, do you want to be hit? Do you want to be harmed? Do you want to suffer? Do you want to have people be angry at you? And nobody does, regardless of how unskillful we are. And there are consequences depending on how we practice, the non-virtuous actions versus the virtuous actions. Which leads us really to tonight's discussion on precious human rebirth, unless anybody had anything else to add to that. So it's linked to karma and continuity of the mind. We don't think about it this way. So we would never use the term precious human rebirth in the West. We're just people. We're humans. And this is who we are. And we don't really think about why this is who we are. And in Buddhism, they spent 2,500 years thinking about why this is who we are. And, the bottom line is don't take life for granted. Don't waste it. Use it to become a better person, regardless of whether you believe in rebirth or you believe in a past life. It just makes sense to use our lives wisely. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is one of the key topics in the Lam Rim. It's one of the first topics discussed. The first one is about the preciousness of the teacher and our guru, and then it's the preciousness of human rebirth. It's that important. Geshe-la emphasizes it over and over, for those of you who have ever heard Geshe-la speak, and, he tells us it's our responsibility to educate people about the preciousness of human life, that we should realize realize this. He always emphasizes that importance. And he has said that it's like the beggar sitting on a box, and the box is filled with gold, but the beggar didn't know it. And he said, that's how precious this life is, and yet we don't realize it. We're sitting on the gold without any awareness of that. And he said that even helping one person realize how precious this life is like building 100,000 stupas, which if you knew the process of building this stupa out here, how many years it took, you would know that's pretty huge. His Holiness has been saying this in his in all his talks as well. So it's just really important that we see that life is meaningful. And it's also very difficult to find. And, you know, when you think of the meaning, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, we have a body that we can move and hands that we can use to take action. We have an incredible brain that we can use to help people and think about things and figure things out and actually change our intentions, change our behaviors and what we want to do. And there's not very many other sentient beings who has the ability to do that. Maybe that black bear that just adopted that other black bear. Did you read about her? Black bears don't do this. But there was an abandoned cub. The mother left the cub. Nobody can find the mother. They don't know why the cub was abandoned. And it was in a national park, and they, you know, you let things run their course. They don't interfere. But they'd been watching this little cub, and it was going to die. And this black bear mother came along. She had a three-month-old cub and adopted this cub as her own. And it's like the first time ever anything like that's happened. So I do believe other creatures have compassion and love and kindness and actually can change their intentions. Who knows? That black bear could be reborn to become a member of the center very soon, very soon. And this life can't be taken for granted. Just because we're human now doesn't mean we'll be human in our next life, depending on, you know, how karma ripens and any non-virtuous actions that we're sowing in this life. I mean, we could come back as a cockroach and kind of start this process all over again until we get a human rebirth again. And they use the example from the Buddhist teaching that it's as rare as, think of the ocean and how vast the ocean is. And if there was a yoke from an ox, you have to remember the time that this was teaching was, and you put that yoke out in the ocean and just let it float around, that it's so rare that it would be like there's a blind turtle that comes up to the surface every 100 years and coming up into the middle of that yoke. Like, that's how rare it is to have this precious human rebirth. And so when you think about that and you think how rare this is, you want to act with good intentions and you want to begin as practicing as much as you can to sow all, as much virtuous seeds as we possibly can. So, I just want to look at my notes and make sure I didn't leave anything out. So, from a Buddhist standpoint, rebirth kind of provides the most ideal condition we have to practice. And they describe it as 8 leisures or freedoms and 10 endowments or richness. So there's a total of 18 conditions that are necessary for this precious human rebirth. And we have them all. Like, everybody in this room has that right now. And I want you to think about those who don't. And I think I will do that one. There's a lovely meditation in Catherine McDonald's book that really helps us see that. So the 8 leisure freedoms, I mean, you know, some of this won't make a whole lot of sense, and I'm not going to go through it in any detail, but just to mention it, are things like, it's what you're free from. So we're free from being born in another realm because we have this human body. So we're free from being born in the hell realm, or the animal realm, or the God realm. The God realm is considered to be, they have it so good that they don't practice anymore, and they just burn off all this positive karma, all this virtuous karma, and then end up having to come back and start in a lower realm again. We're also free from being born at a time when the Buddha did not appear, or in a place where there's no spiritual activity, and so that we can't practice. So those are our eight leisures that we have right now. Any of these realms, there's no chance of studying or practicing. So the 10 endowments are what we have to practice, and these are called the richness. So these include being born a human, being born in a religious country, a country that accepts different kinds of religion, and you have the freedom to practice the religion of your choice. Being born with a well-functioning body and mind, that's the other thing that we're free from. So we're free from being, deaf, not able to hear, not able to communicate, maybe not of sound mind. Now, I'd like to know the definition of a sound mind, but we all made it here, so I think we're pretty sound. We made it here, and we have the capabilities of doing that. So we have that well-functioning body and mind. We're fully able to understand the teaching, and we're born at the time when the Buddhist teachings are here. And I don't know if you, like, we're in a degenerate time, which means that the Buddhist teachings are decreasing, that things are degenerating. And so we're fortunate enough to be born when we still have these teachings available to us. And so not wasting any second, making the commitment to practice is really the most important things that we can do. Oh, yes. Thank you.
I found it interesting that I think last week or so I read an article that was reporting that the Dalai Lama said that he would be the last Dalai Lama because he was concerned that another Dalai Lama would not be strong enough to continue the teachings. And that would concern me in terms of having the teachings available.
So, yes, and that's not the first time His Holiness has said that, because the Chinese government would control the next Dalai Lama. And so, the advice is to say lots of prayers and mantras and wish that the Dalai Lama comes back as the Dalai Lama. But even if he doesn't come back as a Dalai Lama, he can't abandon us. He's a Bodhisattva. He's a Buddha. He wants to help us succeed, and so he will come back in some form and teach. And we have lots of other teachers that he has ensured are here as well. But it'll be interesting what happens in the next few years. But I think he recently said that when he was in Germany. So, well, if I can't find this page, you might be in luck. Okay. Go ahead and sit comfortably and sit in a meditation position as comfortable as you can, back straight, eyes slightly closed. And just take a few breaths. Let your thoughts just pass through. Concentrate on your breathing. Focus your attention. So this is a brief analytic meditation on appreciating our human life. And think about how you feel about yourself, your life, personality, accomplishments, abilities, and so forth. Are you satisfied? Do you find many faults? Even if your present state of mind is positive and things are going well for you, recall past times of dissatisfaction, discouragement, and determine to get rid of this dark sense of hopelessness. To help you develop a better perspective on your own life, first compare it with the lives of others worse off than you. Try to imagine what it would be like as an animal, for example, deeply ignorant, with no potential for mental and spiritual development, controlled by others, experiencing the perpetual round of hunger, thirst, heat, and cold, and living always in fear of death. Imagine being a beggar on the streets of Calcutta, or living in the deserts of Africa, constantly in need of food and water, with no time to think of anything else. Human, but with little more opportunity for development than an animal. Imagine having severe mental or physical handicaps and the lack of freedom this would mean. Or imagine living in a country where there is political and social oppression, allowing you little freedom to pursue your interests. It is easy enough to read and repeat these words, but to really put yourself in one of these situations is another matter. Visualizing and thinking deeply about the plight of the beggar, the fear and paranoia of an animal, the hopelessness of the person in the desert can be very frightening and painful. But by understanding the agony of each of these situations, we learn to appreciate how minuscule our present problems are. Compare your problems to what others undergo. Be thankful for what you have and feel compassion for others' hardships. Now bring your mind to all the good qualities and advantages of your life. You are a human being with an intelligent mind, loving heart, and healthy body. Your friends and family support you. You have the good fortune to live in a country comparatively free of social and political oppression. You have countless opportunities to pursue your creative, intellectual, and social interests. Opportunities to go anywhere and do anything. You enjoy a good standard of living. And most of all, you have the potential and opportunity, because of all the other benefits, to investigate, understand, and transform your mind. Think now how few people or creatures on earth share these freedoms and chances with you. When you have understood these deeply, you will realize how rare and precious a life like yours is. Really appreciate your good fortune. Think of all the possibilities open to you: work, travel, enjoyment, study. And these are simply the mundane opportunities. The greatest benefit this life can bring is a chance for spiritual development, transformation of your mind. Contemplate all these points slowly and carefully. Look at them from various angles. You have the power to control your mind and through it to achieve enlightenment. How, with such power, can you possibly feel hopeless and depressed? Dedicate the energy and inspiration you have gained from doing this meditation to your ultimate happiness and the ultimate happiness of all beings. It truly is a nice little reminder to do. And there are stories of women walking miles, 8 hours to get water and carry it back to their village. So there's no chance of education. There's no chance of anything else. And there's little pictures and videos that you can get just for these reminders of we have leisures and freedoms that others do not. Any questions about the preciousness of human rebirth? You know, in our culture, you know, we lack self-confidence. We don't feel good about ourselves. We talk junk about ourselves. And in this tradition, like, you know, the Geshe's and His Holiness really struggle with that. And to them, it's almost like you're wasting this precious opportunity you have. And by thinking about it this way, it can flip. We can change. We can control our intentions and what we study and what we do. And that's an awesome ability that other creatures do not have. Yes. Oh, thank you. Yes. And when you record, it's just a blank. I've listened to these recordings. It's like, oh, my gosh, what were they asking? Thank you. Go ahead.
So understanding where we are now and the preciousness that we have and relating it back to the karma of past lives to get here, how does that karma happen in other creatures that don't have the consciousness to progress?
You mean like animals? How do they ever progress?
How could it end up at this point, I guess?
Takes a long time. So they burn off karma. So, you know, through their suffering, their negative karmas are burned off, and they're burned off quickly because they have quick lifespan. There are stories of like a fly that flew around a stupa and became enlightened because it saw the stupa. Our pets, you know, taking care of our pets helps them because they're not outside killing or foraging. So anytime you can reduce that, you know.
We're like that bear today.
The bear, it happens. But that's why we have, you know, we have to really focus on virtuous actions so that we don't go back, because it takes eons. At least you or Chris have anything to add to that? Does that pretty well sum it up?
I just wanted to say I was walking around the stupa before I came in, and there was a cockroach on it. So,
see, there you go.
Going for better things.
So we catch cockroaches in our house. I'm sure you all catch them too. But blow on them, blow a mantra on them, and if I'm really, you know, if they're being good and staying in the cup, I'll walk them around the altar or put a little stupa around them. Most of the time they just kind of get blown off and shoot out the door. And when I was filling the water bowls, there was, and actually it bit me, but there was a mosquito flying around. And you know, it's instinct just to swat at. So it was interesting just to watch that in me. And then I thought, you know, watch me fill these water bowls. And, you know, I figure when they have more Buddhists around, even if you're not Buddhist, blow good wishes at them. It gets them closer. Any other questions? That's a good question. So we're going to go from precious human rebirth to death. Actually, it kind of makes sense to me, which is really scary. It's complemented by death. I mean, you can't be reborn unless there is death. And as soon as you're reborn, that's that's where we're heading from the moment of birth. We don't think of it that way. There are three main points of death that we'll just touch on very quickly, and there's whole death and dying practices and a whole study you can do that I really encourage it. It was funny, Venerable Amy, the last time she was here, she stayed with us, and she said that they did this huge free conference on death and dying and stopping suffering and how to be happy in life, and it was like hardly anybody came. And next door to them, there was a conference that was like thousands of dollars, and now I forget what it was on, but it was a really expensive conference, and it was something very mundane, and they were packed. And she was like, you know, I think we just got to do something with our title. And I said, yeah, I think so. Not attracting. But the topic is fascinating, and it's good to think about every day. So death is definite. The cause of death and when it'll happen are completely uncertain, and there's nothing in this life that can help us either stop the death process or to help us while we're dying. The only thing that can help us is our virtuous practice that we've done. So death is definite. It's certain. I mean, you know, we know this. Just think about it. Do you know anybody now who's alive that isn't going to die? Rich, poor, young, old, kind, mean, generous, stingy. It doesn't matter. But yet we live every second of our lives as if we're not going to die. And that's kind of the reality that's always there with, or I shouldn't say reality because it's not reality, but that's the thinking that we have as we go through our day. No matter how famous you are or how much money you have, we're all going to die. So the lifespan is always decreasing. From the second we're born, sitting here, time is passing. So what a wonderful way to pass the time, studying the Dharma. From the second we're born, we move closer to death. And there's so little time for practice, and we spend so little time on practicing. So we just don't spend very much time on developing our minds at all. So congratulations. And if you think about it, if we jump from an airplane and our parachute didn't open, we would have no doubt. Oh, I say that we're going to die, but somebody just lived. That young girl, that teenager, her parachute didn't open and she lived. I still can't figure that out. But for most of us, we're not going to live if our parachutes don't open. And we would have no doubt about the certainty of death. And, you know, in those seconds, you'd be really thinking and preparing. And yet, we really have been thrown from an airplane right now with no parachute that's going to open to save us. The time of death is uncertain. Our whole lifespan is uncertain. We hope that we live to a nice ripe old age and that we live a good life. But we could be in the hospital visiting somebody who is dying and walk out of the hospital and get hit by a bus or have a car wreck or die. You just never know, period. There's so many causes of death. And our body is so fragile. Venerable Amy, and some of you probably bought her book, Buddhism in a Nutshell. She, I don't remember if it's in the book or if she just said it. I don't remember, but she said, why do we think our bodies aren't fragile? She said, we put our bodies behind a car, a steel car, and we act like if another 2,000-ton vehicle hits us, we're going to be okay. And she said, like, why do we even think that way? Look how fragile we are. You fall, you break bones. And I don't consider myself fragile, but I need to reconsider. You can't be certain that you won't die today. There's no certainty of it. There's no guarantee, no matter how healthy you are, how much you take care of yourself. You know, we can only hope. We can only hope. And then the third, and there, it's considered 9 points. So within each of these three, there's 3 points that I've made. So the third one is that nothing helps except practice and your good qualities. So only your spiritual insight and your good qualities can help at the time of death. Your money and your possessions can't be of any benefit to you. Can't take it with you. They're not going to help you feel better. There's really no good they can do you when at the time of death. Friends and family can't help. So the people that you've loved and cling to at the time of death actually can be harder for you because of that clinging and love and fear that you have and they have. And this body can't help you. So it actually, in the end, totally deceives you. You know, all the time you took care of it and all the good you tried to do, and even in the end, your body can't help. So on that lively note, it's really good to do death meditations. And it sounds really morbid. His Holiness does death and dying meditation several times a day, and there's a whole dissolution process you can go to so that when you're dying, it can be like this, that's right, that's going to happen, and yes, that's going to happen. You can actually just kind of follow it along, supposedly. My luck, I'll just get hit by a bus and it'll be bam, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but they say that it's one of the few opportunities that we have to experience the mind of clear light. So that if we practice and we can have that much control when we're dying, you can sit with that mind of clear light. I mean, some of the great yogis sit for days in that light, but even to glimpse it for a few seconds. They say you also glimpse it when we sneeze, but none of us ever really noticed it or remember that. It's interesting. Every time my grandson sneezes, he just smiles and giggles. And I think, oh, he probably at that young age, he gets it, you know, and then you kind of lose it as you get older. I don't know if that's true or not. So practicing can help us with that. But it can also just help you live your day better because it makes it a real reality. So like, I read the obituaries every day, and it's actually almost compulsive, but it's very helpful for me to read them and just think, well, they're younger than me. They're my age. They're not that much older than me. You know, I look at how they died, and it just helps me remember, yep, that could be me. That could be me. And I love it when it says unexpectedly. Like, we don't expect to die. We don't. And it's unexpected unless we've had some traumatic illness for a long period of time. And even then, people say, but they were doing so good just earlier. I didn't think it would happen today. You know, we do that all the time. So Venerable Amy says, a very simple practice is that when you wake up tomorrow, the first thing you should think of is death. Now, the first thing I think of is, I didn't die. Yeah, and so I try to start out positive. I'm alive. But usually you wake up and you hit the alarm and you're tired or you slept bad. You know, all those things are going through your mind, not the fact that, I'm alive today. But you think, I'm going to die this evening at 6 o'clock. Give it a time. That will be the end. Now, nobody's ever died doing this. You're not setting the intention or setting the wish. It's just that thought, and then to think, so with that knowledge that I could be dead at 6 o'clock, what will I do with my day? What will my intention be? How will I go about my work? And then, you know, just watch that, you know. Will you let the small stuff bother you? We'll probably forget as soon as we're done taking the shower that we said we were going to die at 6, and we'll start grumbling at our kids or our significant others or whatever. But if you could keep that sense of feeling, would this motivate you to appreciate the time? It can be a very helpful thing to do. And it's good just to leave a little note, because you will forget to actually remind yourself that you might die today. But wouldn't you want to be reminded if this was your last day? And how you might live it with your positive intentions. So just try it and see. I was going to say so on that morbid thought, we'll move on, but I don't find this morbid. How are you all feeling about it? What do you think about it? What thoughts? Chris, right in front of you. Oh, you got to hit the mic. Thank you.
I don't find it morbid either. I think of it as a, you know, like you were saying, a reason to appreciate being here. You know, they say live every day like it's your last, and you have no regrets.
Yeah, and then you have no regrets. You have no regrets with the people you love. I don't know. It really can be, you know, look at, what happened to the picture of His Holiness that was right there? It's probably out in the lobby. Look at it when you leave, that huge smile. He enjoys every second of every day. And He meditates on death like five or six times a day. Chris, the person back there had her hand up.
If you've experienced death in people that you care about or have been a caregiver as people are dying, it really changes how you approach your life and your day. And not so much that you realize your own death, but there's a real peace in that. It takes away the fear that sometimes constrain people from living life fully. And having experienced that, I find the process of watching loved ones die as having been an incredible gift.
Some people see it that way. Yeah.
In what they've taught me, intentionally or unintentionally.
Thank you for sharing.
Life.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was a nurse, and I still am. I don't practice that type of nursing anymore. And I was with lots of people when they died, and it would just be like, where did you go? Like, that's all I ever wanted to know, what happened. Everything's still here. Where'd you go? You know? Now I know. So the key is with knowing the non-virtuous actions and the virtuous actions, wanting to a better rebirth, wanting, you know, to have a better death process, and maybe hopefully soon stopping the whole cyclic existence, we need to know how to practice. And so we have the LOM RIM. Sandy probably has mentioned the LOM RIM several times. It's a 3-volume set by Lama Tsongkhapa, who is a great yogi master, and he lived 650 years ago. That is Tsongkhapa, the middle of the three behind me. And it's really a beautiful meditation on how we can practice and live better lives. So it's a 3-volume set. He actually has the short version, the condensed version, called The Foundations of All Good Quality, which is several pages, but it really is an outline of the whole LOM RIM that can be memorized and then practiced, you know, at all times during the day, so that you always kind of remember what the steps are. So if you remember the Four Noble Truths, which was probably taught in the first or second session, that was the Buddha's first turning of the wheel, or his first teaching was that, you know, starts out very positive. There is suffering. And even, you know, pleasure is contaminated suffering. So the first one is the truth of suffering. The second one is the truth of the causes of suffering, the internal causes, not the external causes. And then the truth of cessation of suffering. And then the fourth one is the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. And that's what the LOM RIM is addressing, that fourth noble truth. And so you have three primary aspects of the path. You have renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom. And wisdom or emptiness, and that'll be next week's topic, which is another really juicy topic in Buddhism. And we'll touch on renunciation and bodhicitta a little bit today, and then Sandy will, you know, reiterate both of those topics next week as she introduces emptiness. So with the aspects of the path, the first one is renunciation, which makes sense. You have to realize you you don't want to come back, that you want an end to suffering, that you see the suffering around you, you see the suffering in yourself, and you make this heartfelt wish that you want the suffering to end for yourself as well as for all sentient beings, not just for you, but for everybody. So the literal definition is definite emergence, the state of a mind not having the slightest attraction to samsaric pleasures for even a second, and having the strong wish for liberation. That you just realize intuitively that samsaric pleasures are contaminated, the happiness you experience is just brief and limited, and that we're trapped in this constant cycle of samsara. It's like Groundhog Day. You know, we just keep coming back over and over again and not realizing that we've already been there and done that, you know, and we're doing it again. So we have, even if we're reborn to be a human, which is what we should all be hoping for and, you know, sowing lots of positive seeds for, we are still going to suffer. We're still going to have losses. We're still going to grow old and die, even if we're reborn as human, as long as we're trapped. So the renunciation is that you really realize this suffering and you give up worldly pleasures. So some do it by becoming nuns and monks. It's still difficult. Even nuns and monks are hooked on TV shows that they tape and don't want to miss, you know. And it doesn't mean you can't have pleasure or enjoy things. I mean, again, look at His Holiness and the joy He gets out of life. I mean, I've seen Him look at babies, and it's just pure sheer joy, but it's not contaminated. It's not with the attachment and the craving that we put on all of that, and that's the difference. And Rabina has the perfect example that she uses that, you know, if you love chocolate cake and just picture rich, moist, delicious chocolate cake, and you're going out to eat and you thought about it all day, and you get to the restaurant and you really can't wait for the dessert to enjoy your chocolate cake, and you order it, and you're sitting there waiting for the chocolate cake to come, and they bring you, the waitress or the waiter brings you carrot cake instead. What do you say, "Oh, carrot cake, all right, thanks," or do you say, "Wait a minute, I ordered chocolate. I waited all day for this. I want to see your manager. I'm not paying for this. Take it back." I mean, what do you do at that point? Are you just grateful for what you have, or are you still craving what you don't have? And, you know, that's really the difference, that you take the good with the bad. You suffer. You don't add suffering to the suffering by saying, "Oh, woe is me." Nobody ever says, "Woe is me, I won the lottery," or "Woe is me, I have a good life." But we say, "Woe is me, why did I lose my job? Why don't I have any money? You know, why do I have an old car?" So it's taking the good with the bad. And we're happy with what we get. So most of us think about renunciation, and we take steps towards it, and hopefully soon we'll be able to do it. But watch your ego, especially watch your mind when you don't get what you want. Like, or when somebody insults you or hurts your reputation, or, you know, just any time those happen, and just watch how strong that is, and watch how much you grasp towards your reputation or towards that chocolate cake or towards that nice car or whatever it might be that we're grasping towards. But we want to work towards renunciation and being able just to give up all samsaric pleasure. And then the second aspect is bodhicitta, which is that altruistic wish to that others not suffer, that you see the suffering. It's really loving kindness. It's the essence of Buddhism. You see the suffering, and you can't bear it anymore. You want to do whatever you can to make it stop, for yourself and for all others. And it's that altruistic wish. And when you look at the official definition, it's one is a mind of awakening. It's that profound wish for enlightenment, for the benefit of all sentient beings. But
It's a principle consciousness, you know, that mind of awakening that combines the two factors of wishing to free all beings from suffering and wishing to attain enlightenment because of that. So you just strongly feel it. And here's the thing with bodhicitta is nobody wants to suffer, including us. And if other people are suffering, that really does add to our own sense of suffering. So when we generate that strong wish, when we help people not suffer, when we have that sense of compassion, it makes us happier. I mean, science has proven that's one of the only things that makes us happy is when we're helping others not suffer, when we have that compassion. And His Holiness said he considers bodhicitta the ultimate selfishness. He said that bodhicitta is selfishness on a grand scale because we get the greatest pleasure in terms of helping others have pleasure. And this is the way to be truly happy. So we need to have compassion and love for ourselves, bodhicitta for ourselves and others. And we can't help others unless we can help ourselves and we're enlightened. And so that's all the more reason for us to really work towards achieving enlightenment so we can help others end the suffering. And, you know, if you think about it just on a mundane level, you know, when you're on an airplane and they're giving you the instructions before you fly, and what do they tell you to do when the oxygen masks come down? Put yours on first, and then you put it on your kid or who's ever sitting next to you. Or, you know, if somebody's drowning and there's a lifeboat, if you can get in the lifeboat, your chances of pulling somebody out of the water are greater than if you're both flopping around and floundering in that water. You're both going to end up drowning. So if we help ourselves achieve enlightenment, then we can help others be free. And it's equanimity. And we are going to do an analytical meditation on equanimity because that's usually the one that we do on the fourth night. But it's having that compassion and that wish for people not to suffer for all living beings. So it's not just your friends, family, people you love. It's strangers and even people who harm you or your enemies that you still have that wish for them. To have compassion. So, you know, Rubina always says that people think that compassion is easy, you know, because, you know, we think about that bear and we think, oh, you know, or you hear these stories and, you know, many people respond easily to compassion and some more so than others until it gets difficult. And then, you know, when it's your enemy or somebody that hurts you or, you know, a cockroach that's sitting on your toilet seat and you got to figure out how to get it off, you know, you're not feeling so, you know, compassionate at that point in time. So she feels this is really the most difficult, even more difficult than understanding emptiness and wisdom. And most of our compassion is contaminated. We're compassionate and we do nice things for others, but we expect something in return. Like we expect them to be nice to us, or we expect them to be grateful, and so they're often it is contaminated. We don't just do something just for doing it, regardless of how the other person receives it. And somebody shared a story once that was just so honest and so perfect, but she said that she planned Thanksgiving dinner for all her family, and they were doing everything. And she said, we just wanted the perfect meal, and they worked really hard. And, you know, I forget, there was like 25 people, and, you know, all the place settings and all the food, and they really went out of their way to make it nice. And she said, you know, at the end, they were cleaning up, and, you know, her brother-in-law just sat there, and then he turned the TV on and put his feet up and asked for a cup of coffee. And she said, I just kept watching my mind. And she said, it was just like, you ungrateful, you know, after all I just did, I've been slaving away. You can't even, she said that's, and she had to fight constantly not to go there. So even when we're trying to be generous, oftentimes it is contaminated. So it's something that we just have to keep working towards. And there are different ways to do this. One way is to think about all beings as our mothers. And there's a lovely meditation that goes along with that, because with all of our rebirths, we were probably each other's mothers, killers, brothers, lovers, with everybody in this room, including probably the little mosquito up there that was fighting at me. And that's hard for us to get our minds around. And then there's a lovely equanimity meditation in Kathleen McDonald's book that just really helps us see how we just merely label friend, enemy, stranger, and how those change, and how we kind of discriminate just based on those labels that we've given people. So you ready for another meditation? Analytical? So, just take a few deep breaths, just kind of center yourself, and bring all your attention to your breath. And whenever you start an analytical meditation, that's a good way to do that, is to focus your mind. And then we're more able to concentrate on a topic. So normally we discriminate. We either like, dislike, or are indifferent to everyone we meet. These reactions are mostly self-centered, based on whether the person appears agreeable, disagreeable, or uninteresting to me. At the root of this discrimination is our instinctive misunderstanding of the way things exist, especially our own self. Our belief in this I gives rise to the desire to protect and nourish it. Everything we do is for the sake of this self. It has needs that must be fulfilled. It must find happiness and avoid pain. The I likes this person because she makes it happy, and dislikes that person because he causes it pain. Everything is seen from the perspective of this I's needs. Our basic misapprehension of the I makes our perception faulty. The more we cling to this unreal I and try to fulfill its demands, the deeper we bury ourselves in problems and confusion. Our classification of people into friends, enemies, and strangers is probably the best example of this. We assume that the person we like has inherently good qualities, and the person we dislike is inherently bad. We behave as though these qualities are permanent and unchanging, that we will always be close to the person we have labeled friend and never close to the person we dislike. And it's hard to imagine that an uninteresting person in the street could ever become a friend. But these assumptions are mistaken. Our own experience tells us this. Relationships can and do change. The people we were once close to are now impossible to communicate with. And others whom we couldn't bear the sight of are now dear friends. People change, our thoughts and feelings change, and situations change. Imagine the space in front of you, three people, someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone you feel indifferent to. Retain the images of your friend, enemy, and stranger throughout the meditation. First, focus on your friend. Allow your feelings for him or her to arise. Feel your conviction that this person is definitely friend. That is, a person who is good to you and satisfies your needs. Feel how you really want this person to be happy. Immerse yourself in your good feelings. Now turn to your enemy, the person you do not like and who is not kind to you, who does not satisfy your needs, who annoys you and makes you angry, who hurts you. Look carefully at this woman or man. Carefully note your feelings. Finally, turn to the so-called stranger, this person you know a little bit, but whom you neither like nor dislike. Look carefully at the person and note your feelings of indifference. Now recognize that the basis for your relationship to these three people is solely what they do or don't do for you at this point in time. Is this a sound basis? Given the Buddhist view that our minds are beginningless, it follows that everyone has been our friend, enemy, and stranger countless times before. So isn't it reasonable to be kind to your enemies now because they have been friends before? Now return to your friend and imagine a situation that would cause the relationship to end. Imagine your friend turning against you. Feel the resentment and hurt, and how you no longer feel warm, no longer wish him or her well. Where is your friend now? Recall that this person was not your friend before you were acquainted, and could very easily cease to be your friend now, as you have visualized. Realize there's no sound reason for feeling kind and loving towards only the friend of this moment. Relationships have changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Now turn to your present enemy. Imagine a situation in which you could be drawn together, a common interest, a word of praise or kindness. Look carefully at the person and your feelings. Are you softening? You can learn to feel warmly towards your enemy. This has happened before and will happen again. So why hold so strongly to the conception that this is definitely enemy? And what of the stranger? Imagine how one act of kindness or anger from the person could immediately turn him or her into a friend or enemy. There is no inherent definite stranger there, and no sound reason for your feelings of indifference. Remember that your present friend and enemy were stranger to you before. The enemy could become friend or enemy now. Keep the three people clearly in front of you and think about how fragile the impermanence of these relationships is. It is only your misconceived belief in the stability of them that holds your mind back from the possibility of change. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness as much as you. In this respect, everyone is equal. And everyone is equal in having the potential to develop their minds to the fullest and achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. The difference we see is superficial based on our mistaken and narrow-centered viewpoint. Now, none of this means that we should not discriminate on a practical level. It is necessary. Naturally, we feel closer to some people and are wise to keep our distance from others. This is not a contradiction. The point of the meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, whether they help or harm us at this point in time, and to see that our present discrimination is based on arbitrary, mistaken, and very changeable labels. Dedicate your positive energy and insight to the well-being and happiness of all. So that's a good simple one to do, where you just picture people you love, maybe people that you've loved in the past or who you were your friends and now they're no longer your friends, and think about why. Think about people that wronged you and then did something great and now all of a sudden they're your friend again. I mean, there's very real situations that happen all the time to us, and that it's merely a label. So renunciation, the wish to be free from suffering and to free others from suffering. Bodhicitta, the compassion and wish to that altruistic compassion for all, that they may not suffer and that we achieve enlightenment in order to help people not suffer. And the last principal aspect is wisdom. And this is the aspect of emptiness, which is really the two wings of Buddhism. You have compassion and you have wisdom, just like two wings of the bird. And it's an interesting topic, and Sandy will be talking about wisdom more next week. So when you think about the Lam Rim and the practices, there's three different scopes, and the volumes of the Lam Rim are divided into those three scopes, and all three scopes really look at different aspects of the path, but they're just different levels of practices. So you have the lower scope, the middle scope, and the great scope. And you know, sometimes we actually think of those as hierarchical, and that's not really, like, we think low, better, great, and that's not really true. It's just not a linear process, and we practice throughout all of these scopes all the time. And the lower scope is focused on a fortunate rebirth, that we want to, you know, practice virtuous actions and really stay away from non-virtuous actions so that we can attain a good human rebirth. And that's the sole goal of the lower scope. And the middle scope is focused on the goal of liberation from suffering, that we no longer want to suffer. We want freedom from cyclic existence. So, you know, more towards renunciation. We want nirvana. We don't want to suffer anymore. We want out. And we really want to stop the uncontrolled rebirth. You know, His Holiness will have a controlled rebirth. There's other high lamas that have controlled rebirths. We don't. You know, ours is only controlled by our karmic, you know, our karma and our cyclic existence. And then the greater scope is focused on enlightenment for the benefit of all. So our own enlightenment in nirvana is not enough. There are some practices in Buddhism that stop there. And in the Mahayana practice, the whole goal of enlightenment is to be able to help others achieve enlightenment. So we're not happy with just saving ourselves. This is interesting. Several years ago, Desmond Tutu was walking through, now I can't remember in Africa, I should remember because I use this story all the time. I'm sorry it left me. But he asked somebody, a man that was walking by, how he was doing. And the man said, oh, we're fine. And so several times during the day he was asking people, and they kept saying, yeah, we're fine. We're fine today, or we're not doing so good. And one of the reporters said, what's with this? We're fine, when you ask somebody how they are. And Desmond Tutu said, well, how could they be fine if their family or neighbor isn't fine? You know, they're all interconnected. So their wellness and well-being is completely, you know, tied to their whole community. And that really gets at this greater scope. You know, we're all tied, one community. And so a lot of times when I think of enemy or somebody who's done something really harmful to me, to not carry a grudge, like it helps me to think, I hope I never have that mind. I hope I never do something that harmful, and I hope that they purify. And maybe I don't necessarily feel compassion, but that starts to at least start to switch my mind over from you know, begrudging somebody, because I just can't imagine all the people that I've hurt. So each scope has a different purpose. They're all pretty integral to our own practice and our own lives, and we practice in all three of those all the time. And all three of those are part of the path that we want to get on, you know, to be able to, you know, it's that path of the cessation of suffering. So that's the three aspects of the path: renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom. And it's the three scopes of the Lam Rim: the lower scope, the middle scope, and the greater scope. Any quick questions before we dedicate?
Well, back to the precious human rebirth.
Ah, yes.
Back to the precious human rebirth. From what you said, as I gather, Buddhists, especially Tibetan Buddhists, believe in a literal reincarnation, that you'll come back as a sentient being, an animal, a bird, an insect, something. But you gave the analogy of the oxen yoke and the turtle thing in the ocean, so that the chance of coming back as a human being is pretty remote. Maybe the Dalai Lama, a couple others, but the rest of us probably won't. And then that if you come back as a animal that has to kill for a living, like a wolf or a tiger, that's a lower form than, say, a deer or a cow that wouldn't have to kill for a living. Is that all correct?
That's all correct. That's not that bad. It's all correct. Yeah, I mean, to come back as an animal that kills, like a lion, oh my gosh, you know, they have to kill to eat. My cat, who's an indoor cat, but I'll let her out in the backyard because she loves to be out, and she's killed birds. And I think, oh my gosh, I mean, you're so close to, you know, not having to do this. It's instinctual with these animals. It's such a habit. So yes, to come back as something that does, a cockroach probably sounds pretty good, that doesn't kill, is probably, it's much better. But I've asked Geshe-la that, because I just think, oh my gosh, like, what if I don't come back? Like, what if I don't come back? Oh, I get all worked up. Or what if I don't find the people that I love? I mean, and we won't. We'll find them. We are all interconnected. We will find each other eventually, but we probably won't. I know we won't have any recollection of this. And Geshe always says, you're doing good things. You know, you be virtuous. You do good things. And you purify. And you got pretty good chances of coming back as a human. Look at where we are today. So I think about that, and that gives me comfort. Like, how were we born in the United States, and we have a body healthy enough to drive us here, and we have a mind sound enough to think about this and learn. And we're in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we found Buddhism. Like, what are the odds? So we worked pretty darn hard in our path. Look at this life, and you know what our past life has been. So there's no reason, hopefully, to think that we're going to have to start all over. But there's no guarantee, and it could happen. Like, what if I can't believe I was going to say this. But what if I was Hitler, and for whatever reason, right now I just have this awesome human rebirth, but I have lots of negative karma I haven't burned off yet. I highly doubt that. But we don't know where our seeds are or what's going to cause them to ripen. And that's the other thing with karma. It's not just having the karma. They have to have the conditions to ripen in. And we can prevent that from ripening. Like, we can control our non-virtuous actions. That may not guarantee a human existence, but it gets us pretty closer to that option. And that's really what we should focus on, is, you know, what good can we do and what harm have we done and how can we prevent causing any more harm? Does that help? Some. My thing now is I don't want to come back. I want it to end. Just coming back is not good enough anymore.
Maybe I missed this, so if I did, just tell me so. But can you explain what it is that you mean by purifying and what it is you do? Did I miss that?
No, probably not. It's not something I don't think we cover here, but you can read about them. I mean, even if you just say, I regret, you know, it's having strong regret. So you regret what you did and you make the vow not to ever do it again. Now, by not ever, like me with exaggeration, I can make that vow for the next hour. I'll try not to exaggerate. And then you work hard not to do it for the next hour or make that commitment. So you regret, you make the commitment that you're going to not do it. Maybe you do something good and you dedicate it to help, you know, whatever harm that we did. And then there are purification prayers and I think some of you went to the puja a few weeks ago that we had here. There are like purification pujas that you can do and prayers that you can learn. But even if you're not Buddhist and you don't learn those prayers, you get it. It's not guilt. Guilt doesn't help any of us. Actually, there's not even a term in Tibetan Buddhism for guilt. It doesn't exist. You have regret. And then if you regret something, then you make the promise you're not going to do it again. And you do things to benefit that. At least you or Chris have anything to add to that?
Remedy.
Which is the making restitution, which is kind of the purification, or making restitution, like if you did something harmful and then you do something good and dedicate it. So it's the three R's: regret, remedy,
resolve.
What is it?
Resolve, is it?
Is it resolve or I forget what the three R's are. Just so you do them.
another thing. I don't know if this has been mentioned, but how anger can destroy good karma. Did you bring that up?
I did mention it once, but that's always worth doing again, although I don't like mentioning that. So, you know, like we said, that karma expands, and so things you do good, you know, your generosity expands. So when you do something good, I mean, dedicate it. Like when you dedicate it, that just kind of helps, like, cement that good thought. Actually, there's a real Western psychology point to that, and I'll get back to that. But trying not to do the non-virtuous, like Venerable Rubina says, all we can do right now is maybe just zip our mouth. And if we could just stop from those angry outbursts and saying, you know, cynical, angry things, that will do a whole lot to ensure that we're not going to cause harm. So if we could just zip our mouths, but anger can destroy eons of positive karma. And so just trying to prevent that anger is a huge, you know, is truly beneficial. And then rejoicing when we do something right. She shared a story of a prisoner who was on, I think he was on death row. I can't remember if he was death row or life sentence. He killed a whole lot of people. And I think he killed like three people in another prison, and he killed somebody in prison. Another prisoner made him mad, and he started dunking his head in the toilet. He was going to kill him, and he pulled him out like right at the end, and he said to Rubina, I didn't kill him, you know? And she was like, oh, wonderful, you know? Rejoice. I am. Here's one of my favorite nuns. Are you stealing students?
I am stealing students.
All right, we're a few minutes over. I really thank you. This is a great group, good questions. I love teaching these things. And then Sandy will be back next week to finish it, you know, finish the last one. For those of you who missed, you can go back and listen to the recordings. They are taped. So, you know, if you missed the first three and you want to listen, feel free to do so or come back and take another one. If you're like me, you know, the more you take something, the more it kind of sinks in and starts to make more sense. But just close your eyes for just 1 second, and then let's get on the road. And just really realize that you have chosen to spend the last hour and a half learning a little bit about Buddhism, but learning about a practice that you can use regardless if you decide Buddhism is your path or not. There'll be so many beneficial, you know, just nuggets of information that you can take with you and truly rejoice in that. I wish you all a safe trip home, wonderful, restful night, and that you wake up in the morning ready to practice and plan for your death at 6 o'clock tomorrow night. But dedicate all the positive merit and energy that you'll live a long, wonderful, healthy life with years and years of practice. Thank you. Good night, everybody.